Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for being here. I appreciate you showing up. Let's get on with it. Before I get into my purpose, I'd like to read a short verse from the remarkable Lao Tzu. Lao Tzu is a term that means teacher, basically-ish. Translating languages is always murky. Yet, it's been disputed whether it is one individual or a group of people on a similar philosophy who may have collected together a group of sayings that could be the book called the Tao Te Ching, which is what I'm reading from. This is chapter 67, which is labeled by this translator, which is Ursula K. Le Guin, as Three Treasures. I think it's remarkably astute when it comes to showing what I think I'm trying to do here and what I think the purpose of this life could possibly be for some people. Anyways, everybody says my way is great, but improbable. All greatness is improbable. What is probable is tedious and petty. I have three treasures. I keep and treasure them. The first is mercy. The second, moderation. The third, modesty. If you're merciful, you can be brave. If you're moderate, you can be generous. And if you don't presume to lead, you can lead the high and mighty. But to be brave without compassion, or generous without self-restraint, or to take the lead, is fatal. Compassion wins the battle and holds the fort. It is the bulwark set around those heaven helps. So, I've often reread this book over and over and over again. And one of the things that I'll do is I'll just intensely study some of these because it's very vague and it's very general, and that's why I think it is an excellent tool. There are many pseudo-mystical practices that have even been embraced by popular culture that are consumed in mass, such as things like tarot cards. Lesser known would be the Yarrow Sticks and the I Ching, both of which are attempting to, if not predict the future, then to read the lifeline of that person. And so when one uses tarot, one is supposed to meditate heavily upon the feeling and to put themselves emotionally into it. And it is because the cards of tarot are so vague and general, and when you can have a 50, I don't know how many cards are in a tarot deck, but if you have so many permutations that are possible, you can then begin to have a system to describe reality under the guise of telling the future, perhaps, and maybe just trying to conceptualize what cannot be rationalized. For instance, I have a D20, which is a 20-sided dice. It's often used in games like Dungeons and Dragons and others. I like to roll it once a day, and I've been just not really applying any real system, but I try to notice what happens on a day that I roll a 16, and if I roll a 16 again another day, I look for similarities. And I know within the grand scheme of empirical science, it's batshit lunacy. And I don't think I could apply it to anything, and I would definitely never make a decision based upon a dice roll. But it adds a character and flavor of fun, if that makes any sense. I feel another example of this would be the Zodiac. You have 12 sets with certain identifications and descriptions for each animal set or each satellite constellation. And then people begin to personalize and attach to one or the others depending upon their birth months. But if you've noticed, all of these descriptions are heavily general and heavily vague. So a lot of wisdom texts and a lot of what I think makes words reek of this wisdom is the vagueness. It's been seen in cultures that have been isolated from society and civilization for most of their existence, such as groups of Eskimos that range the northern continents that were left alone simply because the place that they chose to exist was so uninhabitable. Yet, listening to some of the shamans and the wise men and women and leaders of these tribes and groups, and you start to hear in some of their descriptions of reality things that are very similar to what is talked about in wisdom texts of other cultures. The Tao Te Ching would be a wisdom text of China, and has been revered as such and has been retranslated probably only lesser than the Bible, though it is not as heard of. Taoism itself is a philosophy of an action. The Chinese idea of Wu Wei, which is very difficult to describe in English perfectly, would be in some way creative in action, non-doing, through non-force, through not subjugating to manipulation. But that doesn't mean to not do anything. And as it's obvious here, when Lao Tzu says, the first treasure is mercy. How can you have mercy if you never do anything at all? If you see somebody in pain, how could not helping them? You see what I mean? Yet, if you were to go help someone who's in pain, yet they don't understand the source of their predicament, and maybe they're hurting themselves, and your decision for help is to give them money and force and maybe to take care of them, yet they could even take advantage of you in that situation if you don't give them the help that they need. You see what I mean? So the Wu Wei of Taoism and the inaction is, how do you go about letting somebody be themselves and, through just like the movie Inception, find the source of what their intentions and their feelings are, and not forcing them to follow your ideal of who they are or what the world is. So, if you're merciful, you can be brave. To be brave, you have to have compassion and you have to care. If you're moderate, you can be generous. If you're immoderate, and if you do not have self-restraint, you'll have nothing to give and nothing to help with, or you'll be so tired and fatigued from giving. If you don't presume to lead, you can lead the high. Leading from behind, leading from ignorance, leading without force, which is something that is not seen in the massive culture that we have on this globe now. With millions and millions of people strung together through abstract ideas of public and society, that makes the United States of America a conglomerate, even though people obviously disagree from state to state and from municipality to rural homestead. And I know I can only speak about my home country, but I feel that amongst most of the Western world and of civilization, when millions of people are all held through very similar abstract systems, even though they have different guises of governments, and some take power dictatorially and force and kill. Yet, the way that the world is operating now isn't from a vague, general sense of seeking humanity, if that makes any sense. But I've gone on a little tangent here for a little bit on Taoism, which I did not intend to do. I'm gonna go on to my purpose now. On The Gingerbread Man, I'm trying to push Lao Tzu's idea of compassion and love of unconditioned love, of being present for anybody that you are in contact with. I want people to be able to look at everyone around them and project, even if unspoken, a sense of love, because we're all in it, even the frogs and the flies and the plants and the grass and the fungus and the little microcosms of life that exist within our bloodstream. We're all in it together in this accident that is life. And that's lovely, and I find that beautiful, and I want to take care of that. And I think that that act is viral and it's contagious, and I hope to pass along a little bit of the love bug to you because it's important to me. Also, I want people to be inspired to seek meaning and to be curious in life. And though curiosity might have killed the cat and there's a lot of bad roads to travel, I think if people are well-intentioned, which I am an optimist and I can't help but think that most people are, then that little inner voice of goodness that I see in anyone, that helps guide. And just being curious, even if your path is nothing like mine, and even if you disagree with everything I say, and even if you hate my voice, and even if we could never like each other, if that animosity makes you want to go seek your own meaning system that's completely atypical to mine, then I think that it's been a good day. I just want people to want it. I think myself, especially, I zombie walked through most of life and I spoon-fed and consumed every single idea that I ever uttered. And many of my ideas are not my own, and originality may be a hoax, but damned, I'm curious. And I don't think a lot of people are exactly in my boat anymore. And I preach this collectivism because I do feel that the natural world is one unit. I think that the universe could be one unit. Yet we subjectify and we experience from the individual eyes. And as Western philosophy will often push, it's important to have individuality and a sense of self. And I don't completely agree with certain systems that want to banish that. Though I think through focusing on self-love and loving ourselves and focusing on our own creativity, we can have a joint effort effect on the group mind and the ubermensch consciousness that is enveloping all of us, that we can't help but participate in until we run away. You see, I find this world beautiful, and every day I want to learn a little bit more about why and who I am and what I could do to make your life better too. Because ultimately here on the Gingerbread Man, I'm trying to help. I see this as a plea where I am trying to produce something and to make something that can have a positive effect, even if you hate it. And maybe you can go make your own podcast, or maybe you can go write your own book, or maybe you can go talk to your coworker or your family, or give your child a hug, or love your dog or cat, or pet your fish. It's kind of cool, isn't it? Well, oops. Let's see here. I've been reading a fantastic guy named Soren Kierkegaard. His book is called The Present Age, and it's a scathing criticism on the society of his time, which was in the 1820s, 200 years ago, and fairly relevant to today. You see, a lot of the things that he was concerned about 200 years ago in the beginnings of growth and maturation of the Industrial Revolution and the factorization of human, all those capitalistic ideas have only been hyper-sensualized. And I have a lot of I'm curious to see what he would have thought if he could see the modern day, especially because the book I'm reading is called The Present Age, which is now almost ancient history. All right, here we go. So this might be a little vague, but maybe you'll get a hint of why I thought this was interesting. That is the idea of religion. But under those conditions, these equalitarian order is severe, and the profit is seemingly very small. Seemingly, for unless the individual learns in the reality of religion and before God to be content with himself, and learns instead of dominating others to dominate himself, content as a priest to be his own audience, and as an author his own reader. If he will not learn to be satisfied with that as the highest, because it is the expression of the equality of all men before God and our likeness, then he will not escape from reflection. It may be that for one deceptive moment it will seem to him in a relation to his gifts as though he was leveling, but in the end he will sink down beneath the leveling process. Their day is over. And at bottom, it is only the individual's laziness which makes a man long to have them back, a worldly impatience which prefers to buy something cheap, second hand, rather than to buy the highest of all things very dear and first hand. It is worse than useless to found society after society, because negatively speaking, there is something above them, even though that short-sighted member of the society cannot see it. The principle of individuality in its immediate and beautiful formation is symbolized for the generation in the outstanding and eminent individual. It groups subordinate individualities round the representative. This principle of individuality, in its eternal truth, uses the abstraction and the equality of the generation to level it down, and in that way cooperates in developing the individual religiously into a real man. All right, I'm going to skip a little bit forward. All right, here we go. In order that everything should be reduced to the same level. So he keeps saying this leveling process. So Kierkegaard is basically saying that his age, the 1800s in England and Western Europe, people have decided to level the playing field. So all outspoken individuals, which is what starts rebellion and has countercultural ideas, are being sanded down. And so eventually he sees that there will not even be leaders in this leveled process, because everybody will be so indolent. That means that they're bored. They're not making decisions. They're just running the script of this civilized process because individuality has died. And then he goes on further. In order that everything should be reduced to the same level, it is first of all necessary to procure a phantom. Its spirit, a monstrous abstraction, an all-embracing something which is nothing, a mirage. And that phantom is the public. It is only in an age which is without passion, yet reflective, that such a phantom can develop itself with the help of the press, which itself becomes an abstraction. In times of passion and tumult and enthusiasm, even when a people desire to realize a fruitless idea and lay waste and destroy everything, even then, there is no such thing as a public. There are parties, and they are concrete. The press, in times such as those, take on a concrete character according to the division of parties. But just as sedentary professional people, the first to take up any fantastic illusion which comes their way, so a passionless, sedentary, reflective age in which only the press exhibit a vague sort of life fosters this phantom. The public is, in fact, the real leveling master, rather than the actual leveler. For whenever leveling is only approximately accomplished, it is done by something, but the public is a monstrous nothing. The public is a concept which could not have occurred in antiquity, because the people en masse, in corpore, took part in any situation which arose, and were responsible for the actions of the individual, and moreover, the individual was personally present and had to submit at once to applause or disapprove of the decision. Only when the sense of association in society is no longer strong enough to give life to a concrete reality is the press able to create that abstraction called the public, consisting of unreal individuals who never are and never can be united in an actual situation or an organization, and yet are held together as a supposed whole. All right. So in the first little bit, a very religious aspect where he's talking about how and why being an individual and focusing on what makes you special is important. And even though he would be firmly there to criticize organized religion and the church, he thought that the only way for people to escape the indolent reality of this society is to seek some sort of spiritualism and to seek God in their own way, even if it isn't the Christian God, and even if it isn't a God that makes things, and even if it isn't an architect. I'm pretty sure that even though he was Christian, he very, very much veered towards the mysticism outlook on such things. A lot of people spurn religion and spiritualism because of how organized bodies of people have burned it. I did for most of my life. And after this, he starts to describe a concept he calls the public. And I like how he says that there could be parties. Yes, you have people in your real world that you interact with. You could even be protesting and trying to make movements in your local government or even federally. There are real people. But at no point do the 360 million people of the United States gather together in one room and make a decision. It's ludicrous. And it's ludicrous that 500 men and women can make decisions for 360 million. It's an abstraction, and we're in it. And I'm not saying we need to burn it all to the ground and have a rebellion or a Marxist revolution, but being aware of how abstract and how insane thinking any of it's real or matters to our daily health and life. You know, the people we interact with are who are important. Our worlds are important, not some idea of multitudes, of public opinion. And with the advent of the internet and access to the globe, we can have this emblazoned and ballooned ego when it comes to our concept of who we're connected to. I have hundreds of friends on Facebook, and 95% of them I do not speak with and do not matter. You know, and I love social media, and I think it's an interesting outlet, and I do practice on it, and I try to do it healthfully. But, and not at one point do I think that a lot of my interactions even there amount to the same feeling that I get when I look a man or a woman in the eye when I purchase gasoline at their station and ask them how they're doing. Or when I'm working and I try to pour good feelings into the food that I serve people. Because I think that if I cook food with love, I can get some of that, even if that is hoodoo, you know? But the stranger that added me from Iowa that I've spoke to one time, none of that matters in a way. It doesn't. We have to acknowledge that there's people outside of our circles, and we have to acknowledge that we can have an impact beyond who we interact with, even. Cindy from Iowa, even if you don't know who they are from social media, what happens if they miraculously show up on your newsfeed one day and it sounds like they're having a bad day, and even though you've never spoken before, you could send them a kind message or show compassion. You can. And it's kind of lucrative how much access we have. We can even be more contagious with our love. So I don't want to heckle that, actually. Well, anyways, this has been an interesting evening. I would like to finish us off before I give you over to Odin with a little bit of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. This shit's probably not going to make much sense, but here it goes. So you're reading this to the dead body or the dead person. You're reading it like before they died, hopefully this person has read all this shit and has memorized it if it's part of their system. And but you're also kind of expected to read to the body because it takes up to 49 days, 7 weeks, or even more sometimes, depending on a person's evolution, to reside as a mental body while the body decays. And so that's why they, like, in a lot of societies, they keep the body around. Like, I know certain parts of China, they'll keep, like, the body in its own room. And then the children will bring it food every day, you know, and they'll tell stories to it. So just have an open mind here. Hey, noble one. It is not really an abyss. It is lust, hate, and delusion. You should recognize this as the moment of the existence between. Call upon the Lord of Great Compassion and pray intensely. O Lord of Great Compassion, spiritual teacher, three jewels I am named so-and-so. Please don't abandon me to the horrid states. Do not forget me. Those who have gathered merit, virtuous and sincere in Dharma practice, are entertained with various delights and enjoy various excellent pleasures. And those dominated by delusion, who have neither strong virtue nor strong vice, have neither happiness nor suffering, but feel only stupefaction and indifference. O noble one, whatever happens along these lines, don't crave them. Don't long for the pleasure or joy. Offer them all to the jewel of the spiritual teacher. Abandon attachment to them. Even without any vision of pleasure or pain, with only a feeling of indifference, set the mind on the experience of the Great Seal, free of both concentration and distraction. That is the most important. So, what I gathered from this is, like, through a certain lens at first, I was like, oh, so if I do good, it'll be pleasurable. But for the Buddhist, you don't want heaven. Like, in their cosmology, you could be reborn as a god, even. You could be Shiva. You could be reborn as any god into the god realms. And there's millions of gods being reborn every day, along with millions of humans, animals, devils, demons, everything, you know. And at all time periods, all these things are just existing, you know, and you just can't sense it. It's all existing at the same time, according to the Buddhist. But their goal is not to end up in heaven. They want to transcend it all. You know, to be a Buddha is to go beyond it, and a bodhisattva is to stay in it and to keep helping, because the world is still suffering and there's always millions. So the pleasure itself is also something to be wary about. The happiness and the mania is something to be concerned about. And as in death, as in life, I take a lot of stock from this book, especially because it reminds me of my use of hallucinogens and some of the trance states that I've dissolved into and that have moved me. And I do think at our time of death, there could be more than nothing. And I'm leaning more and more away from nothing. I used to have a scientific explanation for what I thought happened during the time of death. I used to play around with this concept where they say this cocktail of drugs gets dropped in your brain. Some people, like Strassman, have said that your brain gets flooded with DMT, and this has been arguably disproven in a lot of cases too. But what if adrenaline, dopamine, serotonin, this cocktail, everything that's going on, and your brain just gets, like, wonked in that last half second? And so the last half second of life, you go into that last half second, it stretches into your eternity, you know, and you might have, like, time dilation and stretchiness. Time is another abstract concept, just like the public and the government. And so, I don't know, like, even if there's not a metaphysical existence where a non-physical part of me, even within a completely material description of our universe, even in a very scientific and fundamentally material way of describing, it's still possible that there could be a very long death process, you know? And so what if through practice and through meditation and through conceptualizing and using imagination and creative processes and becoming familiar with fear and becoming familiar with ourselves, that we can acquaint ourselves, and we can be comfortable and ready for it when it comes and not live a life in fear. I do kind of cringe when I think about attachments, like my son. I don't want to leave my son, but I don't have as much fear over the lights out moment as I used to when I was a kid. It used to stupefy me and paralyze me. And just through thinking about it, through meditatio malorum, I have found a modicum of comfort with it. You know, something to think about. That's a little dark. But anyways, thank you so much for being here. I can't tell you how much it means to me to have you here, especially at the end of the show, if you made it all the way through that. I don't take this lightly. This is my real work, and I appreciate you. I think you are a lovely being. I think you are an individual, and you're beautiful. And I am so grateful that every single morning you wake up and you're breathing, and your heart keeps beating. And I'm here for you. So thank you. Let's go see how Odin's doing.
Hi, people. This is Asko and the Gingerbread Man.
Hi.
So I made myself a new name. I'm Asko.
Really? Asko?
Yeah. That's my new soccer name.
Your soccer name?
No, my new video name.
Really?
I have a couple things to talk about. When I was planning that, I was having fun.
Really?
Yeah.
Why was it fun?
Because I like getting new names.
What's your favorite new name?
Asko.
Asko. Do you like other nicknames?
No.
None at all?
No.
No interest at all?
No interest at all.
Interesting.
Bye, people.
What's your favorite kind of ice cream?
I don't have a ice cream.
You don't have a favorite ice cream?
Yeah.
Oh, should I stop buying you ice cream? No. If I were to get you ice cream today, what would it be?
I'll be like frosting.
Just frosting?
Yeah.
You're a weirdo. Thank you.
I'm not a weirdo. You are a weirdo.
I appreciate your time, Mom.
Okay.
Love you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.